Welcome back to the Home Truths Good Cheer Society. In the book of John, chapter 16, we read, "In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." For those who don't know me, I'm a self-appointed collective memory curator. I write about competence, about learning some skills of homemaking, and about life, and about why these would be good ideas. Let's talk about my book, The Summa Domestica, and how it can be a sort of homeschool retreat for mothers and fathers. I never thought about it this way, but then I read this comment from a reader named Gina. She says, "Every summer, I relished going to the homeschooling conference near my city. Just being around other curious homeschool families and listening to speakers always left me feeling refueled and rejuvenated for the next school year. Those conferences ceased with almost no hope of return. Other groups now have online conferences, but I found that those do not yield the same kinds of quiet conversations that I crave. Truly, I miss the experience. Last week, I pulled out my Summa book on education and began reading it straight through to implement some new strategies in my home. Just when I needed the fuel, the Holy Spirit provided. Your Summa confirms that my vocation to homeschool is a gift from God, and I'm so grateful for all of the work that you do to help families understand that." Well, that really gave me some thoughts, and I really wanted to share with you how it is that the books, especially volume 2, could be a sort of retreat, homeschooling retreat for you. We have just enough time before the start of the school year, or even if the school year has started, you have just enough time as things get going and you're settling down to look through it and to get this perspective that a retreat will give you, a perspective of stepping back, being able to see things whole, to set goals, and not to get lost in those weeds, the weeds of, in this case, curriculum and ideas, and even the things that your friends are doing, and maybe some of them are very experienced, and have good things to offer, and maybe some of them are new and themselves are getting excited and also maybe wrapped up in all the varied offerings that are out there. And even the people who are more experienced might have different set of circumstances. They might have different children with different temperaments. There are so many factors. And how do we decide in all of those factors? How do we sift through everything to get the vision that we need to do a good job in educating our children? And by the way, this isn't just for homeschooling per se, it's also for the broader vocation of the family to educate the children. The husband is working hard in most cases. I think in most families, this is how it ends up working out, that the husband is working hard to make the money and keep the family afloat financially and provide. And he is often not able to get down into the weeds with the wife who's trying to assimilate all the educational philosophies and curricula and even school board standards and so on, although she may look to him for help and he may feel a bit bewildered as to how he's going to help her. And so that is why I'm saying that this idea of using the Volume 2 of my Summa Domestica is a help and a retreat for the husband as well. And he would very much benefit Even if, as we are going to do during this podcast, just taking a look at the table of contents, that could form a kind of a retreat for him to offer the two of them criteria for choosing philosophies, visions, methods, and resources. So the whole set of the Summa Domestica really is designed to answer the questions of how do we educate our children. Volume one is about the home culture that we so desperately crave and that we don't know where to turn to find very often because the collective memory has been lost. And so I really try to show and to offer the help for establishing the overall home culture. So that's a volume that forms the background to education. And then volume three, which is called Housekeeping, is really about the nitty-gritty of the keeping of the home and what's necessary, the sort of necessary, if insufficient, criteria for homeschooling. I often say you can't homeschool if you don't know what's for dinner. You could also put it a different way. You can't homeschool if you're constantly stepping over piles of dirty laundry. You can't homeschool if the environment in which you're doing homeschooling is utter chaos. And that is what that volume addresses. In a way, I started the blog with those ideas, but I did put them in volume three at the end of the Summa Domestica for reasons that if when you're reading through, I think you'll understand. So for today, I would like to just go through the table of contents with you of the Summa Domestica volume two, which is called Education. I wish in a way that we could do this together in person. I even wish that this could be a video so that I could hold up these volumes and show them to you because for one thing, they are so beautifully produced. I am so grateful for the staff at Sophia Institute Press and how they made these volumes such a pleasure to look at and to hold. And to my daughter, Deirdre Folly, who did the illustrations. If you have your copy, you can pick it up and we'll go through it together little by little. And we'll try not to take too long, but I'd like to just give you some thoughts on what is in this volume that can constitute a retreat for you. In part one, we'll find the discussion of family culture and what Charlotte Mason called a thinking love. And in this section, I really do go over the deeper thoughts behind the question that we ask ourselves as young parents, and even, believe me, later when you have teenagers and many children, how do I educate my children? How is this going to be done? How am I going to do it? And that, you know, as I say, that's how I started writing the blog, was to offer an answer to this question. And basically, it involves pretty much every facet of life in the home. That's why the subtitle of the work is Order and Wonder in Family Life, because it's the living of this paradox of that we need order. We need things to be organized. We need things to fit into a larger structure. We need to do first things first and so on. And we also need wonder. We need the beauty and the inspiration and the ideas that are really above in order to have the love to put all these things into practice. And I have in mind those who are homeschooling and also those who are sending their children to school. But of course, the mother and the father have the primary duty, and it is their primary vocation to be the educators of their children. Even if they have even if they have delegated some of the nitty gritty of education to other people, they are still the primary educators of their family and their children. So we have this whole idea of the home and how it is that we can be happy at home and have a peaceful and tranquil soul. And for the woman to feel that to reign is to serve, and for the man to feel that in his leadership, it is through serving that he will be truly fulfilling his vocation. So that is the first section. And the second section is on a vision for education. And I talk a little bit about my own search for my vision and how I came to find the ideas that resonated the most with me about how children really learn. And one thing that I have always insisted upon in all my writing is that no one actually knows how children learn. This is something that is very important to keep in mind when someone is presenting you with, you know, the 10 crucial things that you need to know to educate your children, or the one important trick that you have to educate your children, and so on. People can have good ideas, and a lot of times it is, you know, just so helpful to listen. I mean, I'm all for listening to other people and their ideas, and you'll glean something and you'll say, yep, that's going to really help me. But always keep in mind that no one actually knows how children learn. So one thing I try to do in this section is provide a reading list that I think helps us to become convinced that our job is not to force a lot of information into our children, but instead to help them develop and to gain the tools that they need to learn in whatever way is right for them. And to become educated, which I think is different from educating them. And so I have in this early chapter a partial reading list that had affected me when I was discovering about homeschooling. And the authors include John Holt, John Henry Newman, John Sr. Funny that they're all named John, isn't it? Father James Shaw, who wrote the book Another Sort of Learning, Charlotte Mason, of course, who I'm sure most of my listeners are very familiar with, and whose ideas are so brilliant, and who understands very much the delicacy with which children must be approached and the value of a calm and loving mother who has a grasp of what her own role is, which is primarily to provide that environment. William Kilpatrick and David Hicks, Norms and Nobility. Then I talk about many other books. So this chapter was a really funny post on the blog where I kind of just threw in a million ideas and thoughts and kind of packed them all into one blog post, contrary to all the laws of blogging, which I usually don't observe anyway, which are all centered around having one idea and hammering it home. I do try not to dump too much on the reader. That has always been a hallmark of mine, or one I aspire to, of just doing things little by little, teaching and thinking and learning myself incrementally, so that there isn't that anxiety of, you know, somebody has dumped a lot on your head. And that is the way it has to be. And that's how it is for our children too. We can't just dump a bunch of information on their head. However, in that blog post, I think I really pretty much failed, because I just dumped it all into that post. But then in the book, I try to spin it out a little and discuss things in a little more depth. Then I have a chapter about on education and choosing a model. And I think it really is helpful for the sake of entering the new school year to say, this is a model that really appeals to me. This is something that resonates with me, that even if other people are doing other things, I think I can stick with this. I can try it at least for a year, or I can at least glean a few principles that will stick with me. And when you're going through this little retreat, it's well to have a notebook and to just jot down some of these ideas so that you can come back to them. And then there are questions of, a typical Ask Auntie Lila letter, which just kind of throws out there, how do I homeschool? Which, of course, is a crazy broad question. And I try to do my best to answer that. And then the idea of overcoming certain obstacles. And those obstacles are such things as that the grandparents don't support homeschooling, for instance. That you have a child who seems to be a misfit and doesn't conform to any standardized idea of curriculum, which of course is the whole purpose of homeschooling, is to rescue the child from that fate. In part three, I talk more about on the education of children and how it occurs. So I try to go through some very practical ideas, practical matters, and these are really the great obstacles in homeschooling, such as we actually have a life to live, and we're adding to that schooling, and I am just one person. How am I going to achieve it all? And I think that's probably the most asked question, is just kind of, wait, I also have to clean the house. And we also have to figure out about, you know, common denominators. And somehow we've got to fit in field trips. And, oh, by the way, I've got to teach them. I got to remember to teach them fire safety. And, Auntie is coming to visit. And we suddenly have to provide meals for the traveling circus, whatever it is. So those are the kinds of things that I talk about, what a daily schedule might look like, but also keeping in mind that the whole purpose of homeschooling is to fit your own circumstances into your own life and not into other people's lives. Another big question is always that you have a toddler, you have a nursing baby, and how are you supposed to school your fifth grader and your seventh grader when the twin three-year-olds are running around? So we talk about preschoolers and their needs and homeschooling with littles around. And should preschoolers have outside activities and lessons? And indeed, what should the activities of my children look like? How many things should we be scheduling out there in the world that involve us piling into the van and going hither and yon and maybe not getting home for supper? Even though in volume one, I've talked about the importance of supper and the indispensability of a family having a calm supper together. So how am I going to reconcile that to sports, violin lessons, gymnastics, and so on? So that is a chapter in here as well. Then I try to offer a way to address all of these myriad questions in something that seems like it's another added problem, which is record keeping, but turns out to be an important guiding principle for helping us make good decisions. And this is something that I figured out very late in the game, because I am not a record keeper. I am not a paperwork person. In fact, I started homeschooling pretty much, I would say, primarily to avoid paperwork and to get away from having to fill out forms. And so for many years, I just kind of didn't do it. I did the minimum of what I needed to do. Here I live in Massachusetts, and we actually, ironically, for how big our government is in this state, we actually have a very easy to conform to state law about homeschooling. There's not much that you have to do. And basically in your school district, if they get to know you, they pretty much leave you alone. And I took great advantage of that and not only took refuge in being left alone, but did not keep any records other than that one letter that I had to write. But after a while, I discovered that keeping the records can actually clarify your goals, because when you sit down, if you take the time to write out your goals, then everything flows from that. And then you don't get sidetracked. So if, for instance, you have your third grader and all the curriculum materials that you are receiving are saying that they are going to teach your third grader to write excellent 5-paragraph essays, but you're looking at your third grader and saying, my little guy actually can barely hold a pen, and I don't know what we're going to do to get through this year. So you say to yourself, well, my goal for my third grader is that he write a good sentence. And that in the achieving of that goal, he will simply copy out some work and he will take some dictation. That is all he really needs to do to achieve the goal to write a good sentence. And I'm here to tell you that some of the best, most demanding, highly elite secondary schools in our country have this as a goal, not only for third graders, sometimes for their seventh graders, that they simply be able to write a good sentence. Well, once you realize that, that is very freeing. It enables you to leave behind a lot of people's suggestions and instead to concentrate on your goal. And you've written it down, you've put it in your records. When you get to the end of the year, you can say, you know what? He actually does write a good sentence. Wonderful. We have done a great job. Good for us. Close the books, put the notebooks away, and enjoy our summer. So it's very freeing to keep your records and to use them as a method of organizing your homeschool, but especially setting your goals. So that's a whole chapter in here that I think will be very clarifying for you. I have a chapter called On Losing Hope or the Will to Live, commonly known as burning out. This is a big issue for homeschoolers. And when we're heading into August, as we are now, and thinking to ourselves, we just don't know if we can actually recover from the burnout that we experienced last year, I think you're going to find that it's very helpful when we set the goals and we clarify our vision, then we'll be able to say we can do this, because it doesn't depend on us stuffing our children full of information. Instead, what we're trying to achieve is that the child become interested in this environment and find for himself the pleasure and the joy of accomplishing certain tasks, which we'll talk about later when we're talking about the subjects. But in this section, we really are still having an overview. We're talking about summertime, family travel, the sorts of camps you can have during the summer that will be very helpful. Perhaps at this point, when you're thinking about the coming year, it's a little late for that figuring out camps, although there might be time to fit in a week or even a few days of some sort of camp. But I think this chapter will be helpful as you look at this summer and what's gone on to say, you know, next year I'm going to make sure that we do these other things in our summer instead of fretting about the academic subjects that we didn't get to. In the next section, part 5, I get into the nitty-gritty of the curriculum itself and the criteria that you need to choose a curriculum. So the first most important part of the curriculum, which every parent is going to have to figure out and experience a bunch of anxiety over, is teaching your child to read. In this section, I go over step by step how to do this, and especially to confirm to you and to assure you that your child will learn to read, and that the materials that you choose for early reading are very important, but they are not at all complicated. They're very simple. We have to keep in mind that in our country now, for hundreds and hundreds of years, little children having little more than a slate and a piece of chalk have learned to read. It's just not that complicated. It can happen. It will happen. And I talk about this in Steady Reading Progress Without Parental Panic. That's a chapter which I'm sure you'll want to read. And very importantly, and something that I talk about over the years, I have talked a ton on the blog, which is that the reading that your child does must be connected to the past. So this is something that, especially when we are looking over all the materials that are offered for us, we have to keep in mind that people are incentivized to provide us with new material. And that is not actually the best, because not only do we need our children to have the mechanics of reading, but we need them to have their reading connect them to the life that is going around them, that itself is connected to the past. We should all avoid the sort of reading that sticks to one layer of time as if now is the only thing you need to know. Even light reading is far more satisfying when it makes connections, references history, and evokes other things you've read. Great things. Now, this all starts with nursery rhymes, and actually there is, in great literature, there are many references to nursery rhymes that children learn in their youth. And when we deprive them of nursery rhymes and folk tales and fairy tales, unwittingly, we are depriving them of being able to make those connections when they get to what we think of as higher literature. You really cannot read Charles Dickens with any kind of profitability or enjoyment without having had a connection to the literature of childhood, which ironically we think today as being replaceable and something that someone could just come up with something new and give us that for our child and we'd be all set and done. So reading must be connected to the past, and that makes homeschooling much easier, because it means that all our old books will be just as valid for each child. And whether it's, you know, your grandmother who read these same books or your grandchildren who are reading these same books, they're the same books. And you don't have to buy new ones until, you know, they just sort of use them so hard that the books actually literally fall apart and then you have to replace them. I really urge you to replace them when necessary with versions that have beautiful artwork. Today, the artwork that comes along with the vast majority of what is offered out there is truly abysmal, is lacking in any whimsicality. It is a parody of whimsicality. The colors are garish. The lines are disturbed. It is not delightful. And we as parents need to immerse ourselves in the great age of illustration of children's books so that we know how to choose good illustrations. I talk in this section about fairy tales and some of the issues that people have with fairy tales. Are they always appropriate? Are they sometimes too violent? I talk about magic in children's literature and some things that you need to know about reading imaginative literature. You need to know that little steps lead to bigger ones. And in our home, we're instilling wonder by means of beauty, the rhythm of life, and occasionally silence. And so whatever curriculum we choose, we have to be sure that at the heart of it is enjoyment of the work of literature. The work may be difficult as you get into the works of literature for older children. Sometimes they are rather difficult. They take some work to read, but even so, they should be enjoyable and we shouldn't make them into a grind. So when we're thinking about raising reading comprehension and ensuring that the child grasps the material, that is something that has to stay in the background of our own minds. We should never inflict any of that on our children. Above all, we should allow them to enjoy the books. And we can help them by having a relationship with them in the reading of the works, whether they are simple works of childhood or more difficult works of maturity, and not always as a dissection. I would say not as a dissection ever, except as almost a sidebar or something that is very much removed from that primary wonderful relationship of enjoying whatever it is that we're reading, and as an aid to understanding them better. And so that means we have to trust. We have to trust in the work, which means that the works must be trustworthy, which means they must have stood the test of time. And we have to base our trust on reality. Next, I talk about teaching a language. And this is something that is always presenting itself to the homeschool family as an extra, an add-on. But I think that it is very important if we want our children to understand the grammar of our own language, to have learned the grammar of another language. Of course, as Dorothy Sayers urges us to learn Latin. I myself did not learn Latin, but some of my children did. My husband did. If you do not have Latin yourself, there are many resources for you that I discuss in the book to be able to give that gift to your children. Part 6 talks about teaching writing, and this is such a important topic for me. This is something that I've tried over the years to convey to people, because I really think, on the one hand, that learning to write is of paramount importance and that a person cannot really be considered educated if he cannot write in a competent fashion. But at the same time, it is a disaster to try to teach a child to write before he has something to say. In order to have something to say, he must have read. Reading is the indispensable precursor to writing. And not only that, it's not only a precursor, it is the indispensable component of writing at any time. No writer will ever stop reading. And we must always immerse ourselves in the very best writing in order to keep our level of competency in writing ourselves. So the beginning of writing is speaking well, and this is for a toddler and for a grammar school child and for a high schooler to speak well, and as I say, to read widely. Many mothers make the mistake of finishing their children's sentences and of not finishing their own sentences. And I discovered this about myself because, you know, you have a bunch of kids and your mind kind of stops working. You are thinking so many things at once, plus you are doing so many things at once that you find yourself incapable of completing a sentence. So you'll be standing there doing the dishes. Three children will run in. You'll think to yourself, and they'll be shouting something at you, of course. And suddenly it'll occur to you, there's something that you left in the car and you need it to be retrieved. And so you'll look at a likely victim and you'll say, could you, in the car, there's a, do you remember? And then that child will say, oh, you mean the box of tissues that we left out there? And you'll say, yes. And then that child, who is good at reading your mind, will go out and get it. But it's not good to resort to that dynamic all the time. I do believe that we mothers need to make an effort to finish our sentences for the sake of teaching our children how to speak well. And so you can even put that right into your curriculum. That can be a goal for your year, that I, the mother, their teacher, I, the father, the superintendent of school, as my husband called himself, will make a good effort to speak in complete sentences. That will be our goal for this year. I'm going to have a sip of my iced tea. I hope you have iced tea too. This, I have laid out in this section about writing my whole philosophy of how writing will be achieved if you follow these steps, which banish anxiety. So we're going to talk in this section about the mechanics of writing, so important to being fluent in writing is to be able to physically write something down on a piece of paper. Many people are requiring of their children to come up with ideas and put them down, and yet the children are clumsy with a pen or don't know how to type later on in their life. So these are important issues to address. And then teaching writing, I have a chapter called No Magic, Just More Work for You, and writing without all the torture every day in school or out. And this is my list, which I say I cannot emphasize enough, that you must read only good books, preferably old ones. It doesn't even matter which genre, they just must be good and you must enjoy them. Give your child the basic mechanics of writing, know how our language works, and use it well as you can. When I hear a homeschooling mother say to her child, do you want to lay down? Or, I had to lay down, I was so tired. I cringe, because we need to have good grammar and we need to just figure out once and for all when to say lay and when to say lie, and to internalize the fact that it is bad to lie. We should not lie. Lying is a sin, but we must lie down. We must lie down on the sofa. Our child must lie down and take a nap. There's lying and there's lying, and we've got to get the difference in our heads. I have a chapter about playing and writing. I have a chapter about learning to write Ben Franklin style. Ben Franklin is, of course, one of the geniuses of our American founding, and he taught himself how to write in his work as a printer by a very ingenious method, and I really encourage you to look into that and to use it in your own homeschool. I have a little section on lap books and how nice they are, especially for the purposes of archiving your child's work, because they are 8 by 11.5 instead of some dumb poster size, which no one can possibly deal with. Who wants a bunch of posters lying around and then you have to make decisions about them? Whereas lap books just fit neatly into a file cabinet or a file box. And when the authorities need to know what you've been doing, you can just pull them out and that have been neatly stored for you. In part 7, I talk about mathematics. And I think that this is a subject that especially benefits from setting goals and from understanding the principles behind it. And so therefore is very important for the homeschool retreat. The idea that your child needs to know numbers, not just to count, but to know numbers, to recognize five things, and to have in the tip of his mind, the tip of his fingers and the depths of his mind, that this quantity and that quantity equal 10, and these other quantities and these other quantities equal 10, and all sorts of different numbers add up to 10, and so on, and to have facility with those things. First, learning the numbers, then learning the operations. You can't switch those two processes. First, learn the numbers, then the operations. If your child is having trouble with operations, it's because he doesn't know the numbers yet. And likewise, if he's having trouble with algebra, it's because he hasn't mastered the operations. And those are things that are just in life. They're mostly in games. Your child could learn to learn the numbers and learn the operations in the summer. And in fact, one of my favorite authors, whom I mention a lot in these books, John Taylor Gatto, talks about how almost anything that a person wants to learn can be learned in 6 weeks. So we do not need to kill ourselves over the however many weeks there are in the school year, the 180 days. Or, I mean, after all those years that I homeschooled, I don't even know how many there are. But, you know, we don't have to kill ourselves and slog through and have our children slog through. Just rest in the knowledge that really he can learn anything in 6 weeks. So let's just take a week or two. Let's take this rest of the summer to just play some games and get these things tucked into our belts. Tucked under our belts. All of this is doable. I even had a child who told me in eighth grade that he did not want to do any more math. He had gotten up to his second year in algebra, and he felt like he was done. And I said, that's fine, because I knew that he was interested in science, and I knew that he would need calculus, and I knew that he would be able to assimilated on his own. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. What was important was that he understood order of operations, and he understood the importance of, he understood how to cancel units and so on. And so he was very able to succeed in his science classes. Part 8 is about history. History is one of, I'd say history is the most difficult subject to teach in school or out, because it involves a worldview. And this worldview is something we think of ourselves as the homeschooling parent, that we're just administering curriculum, but actually we need to have a worldview in order to decide or of facts, times, dates, eras, whatever. We can divide it up and there's no end to it. So choosing, narrowing down, figuring out, this is what is so difficult. So I have some discussion about that. And I divulge tips for studying history, such as most importantly, keeping a history timeline and keeping a commonplace book, which work for those two things. The timeline and the commonplace book work for every age of reader from about third grade on, and will serve them well up through college and even beyond. And then, very importantly, I would like us to recover and put into our curriculum studying the Bible in a non-devotional way. And what do I mean by that? I believe, of course, that studying the Bible will always be devotional, but there is approaching the Bible in the curriculum in this very devotional way, where we're trying to get to the inner meaning, and we're trying to hear the word of God to us, and we're trying to, feel the Spirit move through us, and so on. But there is also a systematic way of looking at it where we place it in history. And in a way, this is super vital to our faith because it convinces us that it's true. I think it's Dorothy Sayers who talked about how it was when she read a non-biblical historical work that confirmed the events in the Old Testament that she realized, oh, these things actually happened. They're not fables in the one book we call the Bible. They're historical events. And this was something that was just a normal part of the curriculum back before our time. The Bible as looked at in a systematic way. What are the books of the Bible? What is their timeline? How do they fit into history? And so on, including the New Testament, you know, even people who weren't Christian knew what the, for instance, the epistles of Paul, they knew their order, they knew what they referred to, they knew who the people were, who he was writing to. And all of that just feeds the faith. And so I really urge putting into your curriculum the study of the Bible in a, what I call a non-devotional way. And we will get to other aspects of learning the faith in later chapters. So the next section is science and how science begins with observation and how to keep a nature journal, the importance of having a stereo microscope, a kind of microscope that you may not be familiar with. And then I talk about music and art, how those are not add-ons to the curriculum, but very important, especially learning to read music. Learning to read music was in the Trivium and Quadrivium considered part of the education in the liberal arts, and learning about music and harmonies was considered the part of the liberal arts. Indeed, the Quadrivium is mainly, we could say, the study of music looked at in a certain way. So I go through sacred music with children and on teaching art, the importance of a child learning objective matters in art, and perspective, color, and so on. Now, the next part is on the moral life of children. And I think that for most of us, it is, and for the rest, it will become the true goal of our education is, of course, to help our children get to heaven. So we have to really delve into the way that we will approach this throughout the child's life. And I talk about the child's inner life and the necessary delicacy with which we must approach this, and how our current time in our society tramples on the inner life of the child and really denies him the truth of what he feels, the sadness of having done something wrong, really that is suppressed in the child. And that is a very deep wrong, and we have to be sure that we don't fall into those ways of doing things. On teaching the faith to children, how to do God's word with them, how to approach it, teaching the Ten Commandments, which we are enjoined to do by the Lord and are continually reminded in all of our liturgy. And the Jewish people were reminded from in their liturgy, and Christians are reminded in our liturgy, that we simply must know the Ten Commandments and we must teach the Ten Commandments. And that in itself constitutes the vast majority of what it is that we will do with our children in order to give them what they need in terms of an education in the moral life, and how to nurture them, how to have a firm and loving authority with them and not falter in that, how to rely on the fact that in the family there's a lot of affection, and that affection is God's plan for how we are to live our authority. And then I have a chapter on teaching faith to the older child, and how to recognize the need for a good conscience in order to have a life of prayer, and how to develop virtue, which of course, you know, is something that we have to work on ourselves. How will we help our children develop virtue if we ourselves do not have virtue? I have a chapter here, which was published as a separate article, on sex education and how to approach it, and how it is in the bosom of the family that the child learns what he needs to know about sex education, and about the necessity that this remain in the home and that no one transgress this intimacy in any way. Then finally, part 12 centers on just the many thoughts they've had over the years on books in the home. And going through the book, as you can hear from me flipping the pages, just to try to give you an idea of all the topics that I have covered here in this one volume. That's not to even mention the other two volumes, but over the years, we've talked so much on the blog about the kinds of books to have for all the different ages of children. I've had so many individual posts trying to build up what I've called the Like Mother, Like Daughter Library Project, which is to reclaim what used to be the books that were in the library. You could just go and get them, and now they've removed them, of course. And so we have to recover them and make sure we have our own library at home. How one children's book is not as good as another. I do not like hearing people say about some silly series of books that some, monetized publisher has churned out. Oh, well, at least they're reading. Well, no, it's not like that. It's not just a process that you go through. There has to be content. And it really matters. If you don't like the fact that your children are bratty and come up with snappy answers to everything, take a look at what their reading material is, because a lot of times the things that they're reading, I mean, not even to touch on what shows they're watching, really feature children who are bratty and have snappy answers, in part because the adults who are writing them, not to mention the adults who are producing the shows, themselves were raised to have snappy answers and be bratty. And we need to totally step away from that and give our children good material. I have many recommendations for books for the voracious readers. I have warnings about social engineering embedded in books. And then I do have a sampling of the books that I have talked about on the blog in my library project, just to give you a taste. There are so many more. You just have to jump out of this volume and head on to the blog to see how many. I couldn't fit them all into the book. There was no way. And then finally, in the section about books, books for you, books for the mother and the father, to form our own minds, because as we have so often noticed, we ourselves were not the recipients of a good education, because this whole project of destroying the educational system has been going on now for generations. So I have books recommended here that will help us to recover that. There's just a few suggestions, but hopefully they offer you a pattern of what to look for and how to become a good reader with a good library. So that is pretty much the meat of this book, this volume on education. I also have appendices. The appendices are more book lists, albums for listening, because so many times we do have the need for books on tape, and readers and my own children have come up with so many great examples. And also my final word on the dangers of youth ministry. And I highly recommend that you read that one because it is important. So that would be the outline of this retreat. If you chose to use this volume of the Summa Domestica, what you would get. And in one way, you know, I feel a little abashed about making this whole podcast just kind of, you know, get my book and read it. But on the other hand, I have to say that when anybody says, well, what should I do or what should I read or how am I going to teach my children? I just say, well, I actually have been thinking about this for so long. And for 15 years, I've been writing about it on the blog and I put it all into these books. And I really honestly think they will be helpful. And as this reader, Gina, said, they really could constitute a little retreat for you. And if you had a friend or two who also had the book, you could read them together and you can jump right in into the second volume. You do not need to read the other two volumes in order. You can jump right in with a couple of friends and you can make your own little homeschooling retreat with them. I hope that this has been of help to you. And I will just leave you, as always, with the words of my dear patron saint, St. Thomas More. Farewell and pray for me, and I shall for you and all your friends, that we may merrily meet in heaven.
Hi, my name is Dominic Casella, and thank you very much for listening. If you would like to learn more about the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture, please visit our website at restorationchristianculture.org. If you'd like to learn more about Thomas More College of Liberal Arts, please go to thomasmorecollege.edu. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and please like and subscribe. God bless and take care.